Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This morning, House Democrats announced two articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. They are charging him with abuse of power, for pressuring Ukraine for his own political gain, and blocking Congress's attempt to investigate. The Judiciary Committee plans to begin debating the articles as soon as tomorrow and could vote by Thursday to recommend them to the full House for final approval. The House is expected to vote to impeach a sitting president for the fourth time in U.S. history. Trump is then expected to stand trial in the Senate in early 2020. So what questions do you have about impeachment? We decided to switch today's show a bit since this just happened. And so we're going to be on this topic for the next 25 minutes or so. So if you'd like to weigh in on this, if you have comments or questions, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Scott Horton, human rights attorney, lecturer at Columbia University, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and author of the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rose.
It's great to have you, Scott. Well, I want to ask you a question before we begin, or maybe just I want your thoughts on this. I think it's important to remember that we are dealing with a man, Donald Trump, who, according to Michael Lewis, ran for president to increase his brand, and he did not think he was going to win. He was shocked when he won. In fact, Hillary Clinton was on the Howard Stern show recently, and she said that when she called him to concede, he was speechless because he was absolutely shocked that he won the Electoral College. And Scott, I say that because I keep hearing people saying this is unprecedented, we've never seen this before, but this guy didn't think he was going to win. He ran to increase his brand.
Yeah, well, I think we've had a number of writers report that, including people who are close to him and inside his campaign. And I wonder, you know, what impeachment is doing for all of that. I mean, it's certainly putting a twist on the brand, isn't it?
Right.
One thing we see is that Trump is a hospitality brand. It's consistently been rated in the top 50 U.S. Hospitality industry brands. But it's never really rated very highly. It's rated near the bottom of the 50. I think the data from the marketing experts who've looked at it suggests that his brand is not faring well since he's become president. It seems rather to be losing its hold and its position in the marketplace rather than gaining. But of course he has fervent and loyal followers.
Yes, he does. In fact, I wanted to ask you about this. Lawrence Lessig has a piece in Politico called This Impeachment is Different and More Dangerous. And he's talking about how people are in their silos. And he specifically looks at various studies about people who watch Fox News. And he says, you know, when you look at these people, nothing can change their mind. It's not about facts. And he says this is pretty dangerous because in the past, you didn't have this kind of silo media. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, it's hardened silos, isn't it? I mean, you know, I was watching James Comey give an interview recently in which he said that, you know, as the Horowitz report was ready to be released, he was booked to appear and speak on Fox. And then once Fox discovered what the content and the conclusions of the report were, they canceled. They didn't want them on. I think they obviously felt they would be able to beat up on him, and if that wasn't an option, they didn't want to hear from him. So I think that's true. I mean, Fox in particular is hyper-partisan media. Even though there have been a couple of suggestions that Fox was going to move to create a bit of distance from Trump, and there were a couple of occasions when Fox seemed to be preparing to do that, it's always come right back, charging back as partisan media. And I think we also see And the subject of this investigation in Ukraine, if we get deep into that report that Congressman Schiff's committee released around pages 155 to 158, it's amazing because we see in the core of all these dealings with Ukraine by Trump and Trump's agents, we see Fox News figures, Fox commentators, Sean Hannity, John Solomon, who's now also a commentator for them. The whole cast of characters that figure on those three critical pages in the report are people who appear almost every night on Fox News.
Right. And on Meet the Press this weekend, Robert Costa with The Washington Post said Republicans on Capitol Hill, some of them are wary on Ukraine, but they're only being wary privately. He said they think Trump is going to conduct political war in the coming 5 to 10 weeks, making his own case on Ukraine and corruption. And Costa went on to say, we've heard echoes of it in Senator Ted Cruz's interview, which he basically went from Russia to Ukraine in his interview. So what are your thoughts about this, Scott? How should the media deal with this if what Robert Costa says is right, that Trump is going to just constantly talk about Ukraine in the coming weeks?
Well, I think you're right. And Ted Cruz is a brilliant example of that because he was a Ukraine hawk. Very aggressively pro-Ukrainian and anti-Russian. And suddenly this weekend, I think jaws dropped when he did a complete 180-degree flip and embraced this new White House talking point, which is effectively the same as the Putin talking point. And I think, when you look at that that interview, point was made that Rudy Giuliani is off in Ukraine now, or has been there in the last 2 weeks, that he seems to be preparing a detailed counter-narrative. He said he's going to give a report to Congress, give a report to the White House and to the DOJ. So that means it's something public, not something he's doing privately in preparation of a case for his client. And one wonders, is this he's preparing the defense for Trump at his trial in the Senate, or he's preparing a PR offensive, or both of those things? It seems to be the case. And I think if I were a Republican right now, either in the House or the Senate, I would be very unnerved by that because Rudy Giuliani is totally erratic. He says one thing 1 week and shifts entirely the next. They're trying to nail down a defense for Trump, both in the House and the Senate, and they don't know what they're going to be dealing with. So I think it adds a huge measure of uncertainty to the entire process.
And how do you think, Scott, the media should deal with this? If Trump is going to just hammer on Ukraine in the coming weeks, how should the media deal with those claims?
I think the media started dealing with it very effectively. So I think when you saw Cruz give his interview and you saw Chuck Todd respond, he hammered away. I mean, pointing out that the claims that were being made have been rejected by the U.S. Intelligence Service, have been rejected even by the Senate Republican Senate committee that examined and found that these claims were completely baseless. And I think that sort of response, not just letting the remarks pass, but actively challenging them and pointing out to readers that, you know, there's no factual basis for these claims, is the way to go forward and deal with it. Otherwise, we're dealing with a debate in which, facts. Seems irrelevant.
Well, the facts seemed irrelevant over the last couple of weeks of hearings. I mean, it was really, it was almost shocking to watch, to see how combative these Republicans were. Just not even really, I don't even know how to put this, Scott. I mean, some people say they're living on a different planet, but I mean, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, they actually, they went after fellow Republicans who testified to try to change the story over and over again.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, in fact, I was puzzled as to, you know, how the committee report would deal with those things when it was finally addressed. And what we see is, I mean, if you go back to like the four or five highly frequently repeated falsehoods, so the narrative about the CrowdStrike server, Claim that Ukraine was supporting Hillary Clinton during the election, and several other things like that. And we see an editorial decision was made in the report, ultimately, not to talk about those things, just to drop them, be silent about them. So that's the Democratic leadership's strategic call as to how to deal with them, and I think we'll have to see, is that effective or not. You know, the risk is if you rebut and respond to them, over, you're making these issues, you're causing them to come alive, you're making them the center of the debate, you're giving them life.
Well, let's talk about the articles of impeachment. The first one is they're charging Trump with abuse of power for pressuring Ukraine for his own political gain. Tell us about that first article.
Well, this is pretty much what we've all been expecting from the beginning, and it was the clear focus of the Intelligence Committee hearings from the beginning, and then redefined in the first couple of days of hearings in the judiciary. And this is it's about the 2020 election. So I think they framed it very clearly that way. So the charge is that Trump attempted to trade security assistance for Ukraine for assistance from the government of Ukraine for his election campaign. And that assistance was in the form of attacking or besmirching Trump's political rival, the one he perceived to be his most likely opponent in 2020, Joe Biden. And the ask that was clearly presented to the Ukrainian authorities was that public announcements be made and trumpeted that Biden was going to be the subject of a criminal investigation. Whether there was actually a criminal investigation or not, they didn't particularly care. So it was really all about PR rather than anti-corruption. And that is being presented as an abuse of power, and I think it is a classic abuse of power.
Scott, how do you think the Republicans would have responded to this specifically if Obama or Clinton had made this phone call and had basically threatened Ukraine?
I think they would have held hearings and they would have brought impeachment charges exactly the same way. I find it rather jaw-dropping that we don't get much of a defense here. So I think we have a number of Republicans who early on were minded to say, well, you know, this was just a lapse in judgment. It was something minor. Let him apologize and just go on. In fact, there were several prominent Republicans who suggested that was a way to bring it all to a conclusion. But the White House was absolutely against this. So the White House has refused to accept that anything it did was wrong. So the responsive narrative has been it was a perfect conversation. Nothing remotely wrong about any aspect of it. And a suggestion that, you know, pressing the Ukrainians to do what the Ukrainians were pressed to do was an entirely appropriate thing.
And the second article of impeachment, blocking Congress's attempt to investigate.
Yeah, that's probably what we all expected would be the second article, but it's truncated. So the obstruction in this case is the failure of the White House to turn over documents that were subpoenaed, and also the instruction that was given to a substantial number of executive branch employees not to respond to subpoenas or to give testimonial evidence or give any documents that they had in their own possession. And I think what's happened in this case goes far beyond obstruction that happened in the prior case. Obstruction was also a charge in the Nixon impeachment, and it was raised as an issue in the Clinton impeachment as well. In both of those cases, there was wide-ranging discovery, that is document production, and witnesses were all permitted to testify, but there were some limitations imposed claiming executive privilege about certain conversations involving the president himself. So we see a movement in this case to something that is absolutely blanket, simply trying to shut down the investigation altogether. So not surprising that that's being charged, but it is surprising that it has been truncated. That is, the charge is limited only to the obstruction that occurred in the Ukraine inquiry. And that is to say, for instance, the whole second volume of the Mueller report, which dealt with obstruction of that investigation, in which an outline was presented for obstruction charges against the president, that is not being pursued.
And why not? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, and there were a number of other things that were not pursued. There's also the bribery charge, which, remember, the Democratic leadership was trumpeting out several weeks ago. This is bribery, bribery, bribery. You heard that all the time, not quid pro quo, notably. There's also the emoluments clause. There are also tax issues. There's Stormy Daniels. So why not all of those things? And the best I can see is that over the last weekend, there was a summit of the House leadership. Nancy Pelosi is trying to bring her caucus together on this issue and ensure that that she delivers their votes as a group. And she heard hesitation about many of these other points and decided to take the narrowest possible path, the path where she felt she would be able to deliver pretty much the entire caucus in support of votes. And is that a wise decision in the end of the day? Well, we'll have to see over time. But, I mean, it seems to me, certainly contrary to the instincts of your ordinary prosecutor who would want the entire laundry list to be presented. This is, after all, just the indictments. I mean, we have the trial still coming. Normally, the prosecutor wants to bring every plausible charge that can be brought, recognizing that when a jury hears the evidence, they may very well want to jettison an item here or there. So it's common to load in some charges that people think probably won't pass muster, give them something to drop in the end of the day. So this is contrary to those instincts. And is it a wise political decision? We'll have to see. I mean, certainly, Trump and his supporters will say he's been acquitted because they haven't proceeded with these other charges.
Today we're joined by Scott Horton, human rights attorney, lecturer at Columbia University, and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Scott will be with us for about 10 more minutes, so if you have any questions or comments about these articles of impeachment and what's next, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. So, Scott, what's next? The Judiciary Committee plans to begin debating the articles as soon as tomorrow and could vote by Thursday to recommend them to the full House for final approval.
That's exactly right. So I would expect by the end of the week we will have these two articles adopted. I mean, I think the vetting has already occurred internally. They know they have the votes to pass them. They will put them forward. They'll be reported out before the end of the week to the House as a whole, and then we'll have a House floor vote.
And then the House is expected to vote to impeach Trump. Then he's expected to stand trial in the Senate in early 2020. What are your thoughts about this? There was an op-ed over at CNN by Joe Lockhart, who worked for Clinton, and it says impeachment can make life miserable for GOP Senate majority.
I think that's right. So I think it'll go to the Senate, and then it will put a lot of pressure on Republican senators. So I think when we look at 2020, the House seems fairly safe. It looks like the Democrats will pick up a few seats. That's certainly the Cook political report projection right now. But the Senate is up for grabs, and we've got a lot of Republican senators in marginal races who are going to have to vote not just on the articles of impeachment, but also on a lot of procedural questions. So one of the things that I think is likely to occur is all of these people who did not come forward to the House, there'll be a question of whether they should be subpoenaed and brought before the Senate. When the motion is made to subpoena them, there'll be a vote on the floor of the Senate as to whether the subpoena should issue. You got to wonder, you know, what is Susan Collins going to think about subpoenaing Rudy Giuliani or Mulvaney or any of a number of others who refused to testify earlier?
Well, let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Dorothy in San Francisco. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned because most likely, you know, the Senate, being dominated by the Republicans, will probably exonerate Trump, and so thereby letting him off the hook because of his following, and you know, nobody being in his following, being prepared to hear anything against him. I'm very concerned that the situation will basically hand him the presidency in 2020. I would expect that his misconduct will probably be continued. Can he be impeached again in that event?
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, you know, the House is voting these two counts. The House can subsequently vote further counts, and future houses can vote additional counts, and they all go before the Senate. Now, note, in the American system, it's a simple majority vote in the House to issue the bill of indictment or the articles of impeachment, but there's a two-thirds vote required in the Senate. That's two-thirds of the senators who are participating, which is why no president has ever been impeached and removed based on a Senate vote. All Senate votes have effectively acquitted, but that could also be acquittal with the majority vote finding wrongdoing or finding sufficient evidence of violation. So I think the idea of the Founding Fathers was that this was a trial that went on for the information of the public, so the public would hear the evidence and the arguments of the parties, and ultimately it's the public that's making a decision about this, in addition to the Senate making a decision. And does that mean that that Trump will be viewed as acquitted and reelected? Well, of course, Bill Clinton, that didn't happen with Andrew Johnson, of course, but with Bill Clinton, it certainly did. And we had a large majority of the public who felt all through the process that he was being mistreated by the Republicans, and that the impeachment case was nonsense. Well, that's not what polling tells us today. I mean, polling tells us today that there is an actual majority of Americans who believe that he should be impeached and removed, and we're getting up to about 70% of Americans who think that these are serious offenses and he's guilty of them.
Well, thank you for the call. Scott, I wanted to also ask you just quickly, there was an interesting piece at Common Dreams by Alan Hirsch. He's chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College, and it's called Why This Impeachment Skeptic Changed His Mind. He writes, when a president continually engages in inappropriate behavior to win an election, the election itself ceases to be a reliable way of removing him. And like you, he brought up the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal basically hush money payments. You know, he did this to prevent the dissemination of information about his alleged extramarital affair shortly before the 2016 election. And what Alan Hirsch is saying is, you know, impeachment is a very serious thing. You cannot do it just based on like a payout, for example, or not releasing your taxes. But he says that, you know, there has to be high crimes or misdemeanors. He says, however, where there is an impeachable offense, members of Congress consider honoring the presumption against removing the president. The rotten store may be decisive. A president may forfeit the presumption against impeachment. So he basically says, I was against this in the beginning, but I've come around because this has become a pattern. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think we saw a president who was, in his first 2 years in office, more cautious, and I think that's because he had senior, experienced people around him who were concerned for preserving tradition and to rein him in. Those were the so-called adults in the room. Well, they're all gone now, and he's surrounded himself with people who let him do whatever he wants to do, and so I think the abuses are becoming more apparent and less constrained and more repetitive as well. And I think this Ukraine story, which is the subject of these two counts, is probably just one of dozens of such incidents which has occurred, but it's the one that has worked its way into the public and as to which solid evidence has been developed. So it seems to me it's entirely legitimate to go forward on the basis of this. But we should keep in mind that there's a lot more.
Well, let's take one more caller before we end this segment. Let's hear from Faye in San Francisco. Hi, Faye. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Just love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. My comment actually is it's high time the Dems and mainstream media start bringing up the high-level positions of Ivanka and Jared with no experience whatsoever and the types of salaries they're making. Let's fight fire with fire. I mean, they've suddenly kind of fallen by the wayside, and we need to bring to light all this type of corruption on the... I can't even say his name. I call him the dump administration. and the dump decisions.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Faye. You know, I was thinking in the new year, we need to do a show about Ivanka and Jared because she makes a very good point, Scott. There's so much going on. And yet these two are conducting so much business in the name of the United States behind the scenes. I was just watching this Vice documentary about the future of work and automation. And there's Ivanka with the CEO of Toyota talking about how they're implementing this new program to retrain workers when they lose their jobs to automation. I'm thinking Ivanka is, just, I mean, they're out there on a regular basis. And yet, unless you look for it, most people don't know what they're doing.
I still remember back in the early years of the Clinton presidency when Hillary Clinton was given an initiative to deal with health care reform, and the shrieks of outrage that came from the Republicans that she, who was non-elected office holder, was being permitted to do this. And today, of course, we see Ivanka and Jared being given the most powerful briefs, the most important briefs, and you know, it shrieks of nepotism. So, I mean, one's right to be concerned, and I think all this points generally towards a privatization of the power and authority of the presidency. So, a wholesale use of presidential and executive powers and authorities for private and personal benefit. And I think we're going to see, you know, ultimately, I think the shields are up right now, but when they're down, we're probably going to see a lot more. I just keep seeing every week with the killings that occurred at Pensacola and the response of Trump to it and his just bizarre obeisance towards the Saudis the whole time. I keep thinking we're at some point going to see that there's a reason why he's always so deferential to the Saudis. And it probably has to do with relations that he and Jared Kushner developed with them, commercial relations.
Wow. Well, thank you, Faye, for that. We will definitely do a show about those two and catch up on what they've been doing in the name of the U.S. Scott Horton is a human rights attorney and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Thank you. Coming up after a break, we're going to switch gears. We'll be joined by historian Peter Cole. He's out with a new book called Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.